If you know anything at all about Charles Darwin's work leading up to the theory of evolution, you know about Darwin's work in the Galapagos Islands. Darwin spent 5 weeks in the Galapagos in the 19th century, noting the way flora and fauna developed there, far removed from the flora and fauna of much of the rest of the world. That is still a draw for the islands, and still worth talking about, and still worth writing about, as today's guest demonstrates with his book on the islands, The Galapagos, A Natural History. Henry Nichols is the author. He's a science writer who writes for a number of publications. He also writes the Animal Magic blog for The Guardian in England. His two previous books include Lonesome George, the story of a Galapagos tortoise, the only one of his kind. Henry Nichols, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So have you gone essentially from micro to macro here, from George to the larger area in which he lived?
In some ways, yes, I have. That first book, it did cover the entire archipelago, and it also had a strong global aspect to it. So I pulled away from Galapagos wherever I could to explore some of the challenges that the Galapagos faces and how they are mirrored elsewhere in the world. So there were aspects of that book that were very narrow, that focused just on George and his story, and then there were some that were and from that, I've definitely, this is a much more kind of epic biography of the archipelago. But in some senses, this is more constricted. So that was I moved away in that book to the other parts of the world, and this one is focused very much on the islands.
And you take away some mystery for the non-Spanish speakers right away. What does Galapagos mean?
It means, I suppose, the tortoises. Would be the literal translation. The Islas Galapagos would be islands of the tortoises.
All right, so the very islands are about tortoises themselves. Now, your own fascination with the Galapagos, how far back does that go, and how much have you been there yourself?
I guess my own interest in evolutionary biology kind of began in my teens, my late teens, and then studying evolutionary biology at university. Obviously, Darwin becomes a very important figure for me in my own research. And then once you've sort of latched onto Darwin, of course, then, as you've indicated, the Galapagos becomes this kind of mecca. So a lot of people are drawn to Galapagos because of that Darwin connection. And that was really what drew me there. And I first went there 10 years ago, and I went back in 2012 to catch up a little bit with the islands and research the human side for this book.
Given how much is written about the Galapagos Islands and reported and put on websites, et cetera, I mean, there's lots of ways to find out a lot about them. So, and yet, by the time you got there the first time, how did it match up with what your preconceived notions might have been?
I was stunned, really. Probably most people that go there or would like to go there know that this is going to be an extraordinary place that is going to really just, you know, hopefully, you it's a very expensive trip, so you don't make it lightly, and you're hoping is going to sort of stay with you forever. And I guess I had those hopes, but I couldn't have really anticipated just how extraordinary the islands were. The most exciting thing, I think, the thing that has the most impact is something that Darwin noted himself, and that what he described in his Voyage of the Beagle as the tameness of the birds. He meant, really, well, he was talking about all creatures there have this tameness, or at least they're not frightened of humans at all. And you've read about this before you go to the Galapagos. You know it's going to happen. And yet when you get there, it just completely knocks you sideways in a way you can't prepare for that experience of getting so unbelievably close to wild creatures and feeling suddenly that your position in the world is not really as you'd imagined it. It completely alters one's perspective on the relationship between humans and the natural world.
In a sense, the creatures on the Galapagos have been lucky, and by extension, I think all of the planet has been, in that because the dodo birds were also equally docile, and look what happened to them. So the fact is that so many of these creatures are still alive is a very good thing, and kind of a lucky thing, I guess.
Yes, it is. And the Galapagos, you know, the explanation for that is that the Galapagos was only discovered late. Of course, the islands in the Indian Ocean and Mauritius, where the dodo was, were discovered. They were discovered around the same time, but the human impact there was instantaneous, and there was a very dramatic change. So lots of humans suddenly started coming, and settlements sprung up. In the Galapagos, though, it was discovered first in 1535. The first 300 years after that, it's pretty much characterized by people wanting to stay away from the place, largely. Certainly no one wanted to live there. But people coming to exploit things, for sure, but no one wanted to live there. It was, for the first few hundred years, something like hell on Earth.
All right, we'll explain exactly how much of a hell on Earth that is. The Galapagos is the name of the book and the place. Henry Nichols, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is A Natural History of the Galapagos Islands. We'll come back and talk more with Henry and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Henry Nichols. He has written a whole bunch of works in science, a lot of articles, several books, and his latest book is called The Galapagos, A Natural History. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the Galapagos Islands and their significance in today's world, and certainly in the work of Charles Darwin. Darwin is mentioned a lot in the book. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782, and our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Henry, that was really interesting what you just said before the break about how people viewed the Galapagos as a hell on Earth. I mean, what is it about it? Because, I mean, from some perspectives, it's something like a Garden of Eden, I think, in some people's minds, diversity. But
it is now. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, this is this fascinating thing that other people have noted, but it is this transition from a hell on Earth to paradise, which just does make the islands very fascinating to think about and how that change came about. But it's certainly for the person who discovered the islands was, in fact, was the most important person in South America at the time, the Bishop of Panama. So their ship, they were just trying to coast down from Panama down to Peru and along the coast, and got blown out and caught on the currents that drift out quite strongly from Central South America out along the equator. And they would have certainly thought, well, they'd had it. You know, there was nothing on the map out there. And then after a few days, these islands appeared on the horizon, sort of smoking away. And so I think they sort of imagine they'd been saved, and it did save them, in fact. They'd run out of water, drinking water, and eventually they found some on the island. But from the bishop's report back to the Spanish king, he clearly didn't really like the islands. So he said, his description is, "I do not think there's a place where one might sow a bushel of corn, because most of it's full of very big stones. So much so that it seems as though at some time God had showered stones." And certainly on the lower stretches of the islands, which really dominate the islands, it's a very, very bleak, rocky, inhospitable sort of world. And there are lots of accounts. So Herman Melville was there on a whaling ship that would inspire his Moby Dick novel, but he wrote a series of essays about the islands, and some of those capture brilliantly that sort of horrendous lower stretches. He says in many places, the coast is rock-bound, or more properly clinker-bound, tumble masses of blackish or greenish stuff, like the dross of an iron furnace, forming dark clefts and caves here and there. And Darwin, a little bit before him, made very similar sort of description of those lower stretches. And then you have these animals on there, and the most striking two are the marine iguanas, which are kind of would have looked like dragons to these early visitors. Little, they're small, they're only about a couple of feet long, but they sort of would have been covering, and they still cover all the shores, you know, they're just lying on top of each other. So this mass of seething reptiles, and, well, they kind of don't move, but it would have been very frightening. You'd have to step over these things that you'd never seen before, and then one imagines there were a lot of giant tortoises. So there are now probably about 10, 20,000 individuals, and it's really anyone's guess how many there were, but at least 200,000, possibly a million of these. So very big reptiles, and it was just kind of so extraordinary for these early visitors that very little fresh water. So the idea of setting up and staying there, and it was just didn't enter anyone's radar until really the middle of the 19th century.
Henry Nichols, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Galapagos, A Natural History. Was there any prehistoric habitation, any evidence of people having spent any time there?
People have looked for that quite extensively, and one idea is that American Indians, Amerindians from South America, had somehow got out west before, but there's no evidence of that, really. No serious evidence. So I think we have to take 1535, at least this is what most people assume, is 1535 and the Bishop of Panama as the first human footfall on the islands.
Wow. So they really were untouched through all that time up until then. How did the Japanese invasion, Henry, of Pearl Harbor have a bearing on the Galapagos?
Well, yes, it did. And I suppose it's very important to the way we now see it. So at that moment, when that happened, America very understandably needed to, they wanted to find somewhere where they could keep a control on the Panama Canal, which is kind of this crucial link. And the Galapagos seemed perfectly placed for this. So they approached Ecuador, which owns the islands, and asked if they could sort of build a military base in the Galapagos. I'm not sure Ecuador was entirely keen on this, but of course this was in the middle of the war, and America got their way. It was very difficult, but built an airstrip on one of the islands that's slightly flatter than the others. But a huge, horrendous job just leveling this unbelievably sharp, vicious kind of volcanic rock. And then once you had a military base there with a runway, then air visits to the island became possible. And really, I suppose that, you know, that just after the war, the islands were still not really touched for another couple of decades, but from the early 70s onwards, that airstrip, or a second airstrip that was built, then became, this sort of gateway to the Galapagos, and now you have so many flights a day. That expansion has allowed now 200,000, the very latest figure from the Galapagos National Park is that 2013 there were 200,000 visitors to the Galapagos, and there are two islands that now have big runways, and a third that has a smaller airstrip that you can fly into.
How difficult is it to get to the islands? I mean, obviously ships can cross the ocean, but I mean, how difficult was it to find a landing place for ships?
Before the airstrips?
Yes.
Yes, some of the islands are very difficult to land on because you have these sheer and really difficult sharp terrain, uneven terrain that you've got to get out at, and often large swell. And so the boat you're in, this tender, is rising and dropping against a really sharp, vicious, usually often vertical face. So when you read the reports of researchers who are trying to go onto little islands to study this, that, and the other, they find it very difficult. It's quite dangerous. Of course, some of the islands have more natural harbours that make landing much easier. There are beaches where all the settlements, the four islands really have settlements, and they're all located around beachy areas where it's possible to anchor and then come in quite safely.
Henry Nichols, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, science writer, the author of The Galapagos, A Natural History. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about these very important islands and their very important history. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. You write that the Galapagos Archipelago matters to us all. How, Henry?
That was one of the reasons, really, for writing the book. So you're absolutely right. There are a lot of books about the Galapagos and a lot of very good books about the Galapagos. And I really wanted to, you know, partly from my own sense, just to really figure out why these islands matter to us, because they do, but there's not a lot of thought that's sort of given to that. And I built up a nested series of arguments. So they matter, of course, to the people that live there. There are 30,000 people that live there. So, you know, quite a lot of people don't even know that. And then...
Is that 30,000 live there?
30,000, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, it's quite a serious sort of human population there. And so the islands obviously quite evidently matter to those. They matter to the people that want to go there to visit. But, you know, I suppose that's just a couple of 100,000 people a year. It doesn't really... not very significant. Why do the islands matter to everybody else? More broadly, of course, they matter a lot to Ecuador. It's a very small country, occupying something like 2% of South American landmass, and it's got a huge biodiversity. But it's not that mainland continental biodiversity that really attracts international tourists. It's this far-flung group of islands that they annexed in 1832, the Galapagos, which doesn't have very much, actually. There's only 4,000 native species there, but people want to visit. And something like almost half of all revenue that comes in to Ecuador from international tourism can be attributed to the Galapagos. So quite clearly, the Galapagos has an economic importance to Ecuador, and therefore very seriously is politically very important. And beyond Ecuador, it matters pretty much to everybody else, even if you don't want to visit what is reckoned to be the best preserved tropical archipelago left on the planet, which is another reason which makes it special. Even if you don't want to visit, the islands are important because of this really weird association between Darwin and the Galapagos, which I say weird because you mentioned it right at the beginning. He was only there for 5 weeks, and he didn't have a eureka-like moment in the Galapagos, contrary to the sort of popular accounts that we quite often read about. But he did have an experience that stayed with him for a long time. And in the years to follow, in the decades to follow, the islands and his experience there and the collections he made were very central to the development of his idea of evolution by natural selection, which, whether you like it or not, or you believe in it or not, or believe that it accounts for the origin of species or not, it is a very, very important idea in human society in the 21st century. It affects not just our understanding of the natural world, but pretty much everything we do. So any efficiency, any process, human process, where we're looking to make things more efficient, we apply the same logic that evolution uses, this process of natural selection. So we kind of all depend. It's a very influential thought, and a lot of it the origins of that idea, that very important idea, can be attributed to the Galapagos. So thinking about the Galapagos is just a very nice way to begin thinking about this really important, very, very powerful idea.
At the time that Charles Darwin traveled there, and that was in the 1830s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
How well known were the Galapagos Islands?
I suppose naturalists and the admiralties and the naval figures would have known about it, and the whalers, of course. But beyond that, no, nobody. I mean, I still think, although most people have heard of the Galapagos, I think a lot of people, if pushed, wouldn't really know where they are, and wouldn't really know that much about them. So, if that's the case in this amazing information age that we're in, I think people would not have heard of them at all, even less so known anything about them or where they are.
Henry Nichols is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Galapagos, A Natural History. The islands formed volcanically, is that right?
That's right.
And when was the most recent evidence of any volcanic activity? Is it possible they could come to life again?
Well, they're still active. All the western edge of the archipelago is sort of hovering. I say hovering. It lies over a very active, what's known as a hot spot. So a deep, very active part beneath the crust that occasionally will sort of build such great pressure that it blasts through. And so this is how the islands form, and the plate on which the islands sit, which is called the Nazca Plate, is being moved towards South American continent, so to the south and east slightly. Every year it shifts a few centimeters or meters or so, and as that happens, then after a few hundred thousand years above the hotspot, there will be nothing. It's just ocean, and then the hotspot throws up a new eruption and it turns into an island. And after a few more hundred thousand years, that island has moved off to the southeast and is shrinking and weathering down and getting lower, and another one comes up to the west. And so the islands are like it's like a conveyor belt, just constantly belching out a new island in the west and the ones in the east sinking down.
That's a great image, the conveyor belt of islands coming and going. It sounds like we're still learning a lot about the place. I mean, is much of our knowledge about the whole Galapagos archipelago from within the last century or so?
Yes, certainly the natural aspects of it. It became, towards the late 19th century, once Darwin's ideas had started to gain traction, certainly within the community of naturalists, then people started turning towards the Galapagos as the place they wanted to go to study. And so from the late 19th century, you see these kind of Darwin enthusiasts going and collecting and studying. And those collections, late 19th century collections, are very important to modern research because they give a kind of benchmark of what things were like, and so against which you can compare what things are like now. But most of the discoveries, I suppose, about the behavior and the evolution of the plants and animals that are there dates from about the 1930s, very earliest, but more coherently from the 1970s.
Is the reason for the development of all these creatures that are odd to the rest of the world just the physical distance that separates the islands from the rest of the world?
It's just the isolation that they provide, which is a consequence of the distance. Obviously helps because it means new things don't arrive that often. It's very difficult for instance, frogs or any kind of amphibians that can't handle salt water to get to the Galapagos, which is why there's virtually no amphibians in the Galapagos, and mammals similarly, almost none. There's an endemic rat-type creature, but no mammals, and everything else kind of struggled to get there. So you have very drip feed of colonists coming, only very, very rarely. And then within the archipelago itself, there's this distance of maybe 30, 40 kilometers between islands. And each of those then offers a kind of whole setup in which things can begin to look slightly different from the island that they just came from.
Isolation even within the archipelago. Yes, much more to talk about with the Henry Nichols about his book, The Galapagos, A Natural History. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails and Henry Nichols in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Henry Nichols, the author of many articles about the natural world and about science. And he's also the author of several books, including the brand new The Galapagos, A Natural History. And a lot to talk about here about the Galapagos Islands and why they are the way they are and why the world knows what it knows about those islands and what else we can learn from them. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I should point out that the book is divided up into 10 chapters by rocks, ocean, seabirds, plants, invertebrates, land birds, reptiles, and then the final three chapters on humans, because much to say about humans and their impact on the islands. We were just talking about the isolation and the differences even from island to island, and finches come up big in this book and, of course, in Darwin's work as well. What is it about finches, the birds, that made them so interesting to Darwin and still keep us captivated now?
I suppose it's different ways to answer that. One is just that birds are quite a good species to study, and there's quite a long, solid tradition of ornithological research. So if I were to hazard a guess, it would probably be a bird that was going to be, that would end up being the species that became the focus of a lot of research. And it was this group of 14 or so species of finch, as they turned out to be, though Darwin misidentified a few of them. And they have a very measurable, they have a very obvious difference between them. They're all roughly similar size, and there's variation in size, not much in color, but they have a very clear gradation of bill size, so their beaks are very different, and you can measure that quite easily. And that's the really, in combination with their size, it's the beaks that has become the trait, the characteristic that the researchers have latched in on. And it's possible then to, in this group of birds, but in particular focusing in, if you focus in on one species of finch, you can watch, you can see evolution happening in a matter of weeks or in real time. You can see evolutionary change occurring, which is, you know, it's quite a remarkable thing. That makes the finches, that's the reason they're so important and have become this kind of example, schoolroom example of evolution.
And I'd forgotten until I picked up your book that there actually is a Galapagos penguin, but, I mean, how different is it from penguins in the rest of the world?
A little bit. It's smaller. Most of them. It's not the smallest, but it's and presumably that we think that reduction in size is an adaptation to this very, very northerly, it's the most northerly dwelling penguin species. So you don't get any in the northern hemisphere except for a couple of populations in the Galapagos, which straddles the equator. And so it's the only penguin to occur in the northern hemisphere. That is because the waters around the Galapagos are still, though they are on the equator, it should be really hot there, and it is, but the waters are extremely cold. So there's these deep upwellings that come up from Antarctica and then rise to the surface in Galapagos, and then from the west, very, very cold deep current that comes up and hits this these underwater mountains and rises up to the surface there. So the waters around it are very similar to the sorts of waters in which penguins would normally live. The above sea conditions, so there's lots of food that they're happy with usually, but the above up on the land where they have to nest is a real challenge for the heat is a real challenge for the penguins.
Which brings up the question about how much change is being noticed in climate even there. I mean, we've certainly talked to people who know birds in our part of the world about species they're seeing much farther north than they used to go simply because the seasons are warmer than they used to be farther north. Are there changes that are being seen in the populations on the Galapagos given climate change?
It's difficult to attribute changes to climate change in just the same way as there's a big climatic event and everybody says, is it climate change? Well, it might be and it might not be. So on a very short time scale, it's a very difficult question to answer. My hunch would be that, yes, these population changes, which of course have always happened and are a central part of the evolutionary process. You have to have death in order to have evolution. But they're becoming much more exaggerated. And in particular, the what they call El Nino events, which happen every 5-10 years or so. When that happens in Galapagos, it's an extraordinarily dramatic effect on the wildlife, in particular those species that depend on that cold water environment, which is characterized as Galapagos, because what happens is that those currents fail and the waters rise in temperature from around 18 degrees normally to more than 30 degrees. It's incredibly warm then, the water. And the cold water fish species that are these penguins and sea lions and flightless cormorants and all the other seabirds are depending on vanish. And so you see massive levels of death amongst those populations, huge crashes, sort of sometimes 80% of a population just vanish. And that is crucial, and you then to that evolutionary process we were talking about, you then see very dramatic changes quite often after those levels of death. One of the most fascinating for me is this story of the marine iguanas. So they feed, this is their fascinating for being a reptile that goes and swims in the sea for its food, but they feed on these algae that are on the rocks just off the shores. In the very hot years, these El Nino years, that algae kind of dies off and they have absolutely no food, and you get massive levels of death, sort of 9 out of 10 animals dying. And what we've also noticed, researchers have also noticed, is that some of those individuals that survive seem to be able to reduce their skeleton within the space of a few months, so they actually shrink.
Within individual animals?
Yeah.
Wow.
When the researchers first, they were looking through their data and they sort of had these animals tagged and were saying, hold on, they seem to be shorter than we measured them last year. So they thought they'd mismeasured it, we didn't really measure accurately. But they kept coming up, this very consistent, and it's not just one individual, it's every individual that survives, actually, that we tagged in previous years, is now shorter. And when you look at it, they're one of the few instances, which I imagine this is a more widespread phenomenon, but that individuals in very dramatic situations have somehow evolved the ability to remodel and reshape and reallocate resources. So they can actually shrink and reduce the expenditure they're making on their skeleton. They become something like 5-10% shorter, a matter of centimeters shorter than they would normally have been.
That's incredible. So, I mean, yeah. Just adaptations, not just within a species, but within an actual individual creature.
Yeah. Well, that is, and so those pressures, that cycle of death. So that sometimes the Galapagos is a great place to live for these creatures, but others it's absolutely horrific. And so you do see large amounts of death. And then in those situations, you expect to see adaptations like this. Really fascinating ways in which species have managed to hang on by coming up with some crazy adaptations that can see them through those difficult times. So going back to your original question, because I digressed there, those dramatic events, we think the El Niños are becoming more frequent and more exaggerated, probably as a result of climate change. And if that happens, those crashes become more frequent and larger, and the species like the Galapagos penguin, it becomes more likely they go extinct. So there's only a matter of hundreds of those individuals left, and if you can very, very quickly reduce the population to just a few hundred, and then they're gone.
I have to wonder then, just in general, in more direct terms, about human impacts on the place. And of course, you do spend three chapters on human impacts on the Galapagos. How it is that so many creatures still survive? I mean, obviously, it's not a hospitable place, so not terribly many people live there, all told. But lots of visitors there, lots of opportunity for things to go wrong, sewage spills, and all the other sorts of things, and you know, rats aboard ship, and all that sort of stuff. I mean, have there been some major impacts that humans have not been able to stop in time?
No, I mean, I'd say that the islands are remarkably pristine, so we've only documented very, very few extinctions there, and a lot of species, most species, are affected in some way because of humans, but very few extinctions. Nature and the natural world, if left alone, not even completely alone, just a little bit, if the pressure's taken off, is remarkably resilient and productive. And so stuff can bounce back if given the chance. And some of the interventions that the conservation community have managed in the last few years, two of them in particular, are sort of striking illustrations of the way that humans can actually help to just take off those anthropogenic influences and pressures on animals. And one of them was the removal of large numbers of large mammals, so goats mainly, pigs also. So this really concerted, almost decade-long hunting campaign, which got very, very sophisticated in some of its methods and really pioneered or took mammal eradication, invasive mammal eradication, because these goats are all introduced, pigs are all introduced, to whole new levels of sophistication. But that then took the pressure off the vegetation, which had been completely razed to the ground by these herbivores. And then, with the vegetation bouncing back, then the giant tortoises and the other herbivores that are supposed to be there can bounce back. And you certainly see that already with the vegetation, remarkably, you know, coming back so quickly. And that's got to be good things for the more kind of charismatic fauna like the giant tortoises. And the other is a more recent intervention, but is all ongoing, and it's eradication of rats using large amounts of rat poison, which is not done lightly. You know, there's collateral damage with these, and it's a process of minimizing and that, and working, assessing the risk. But rats, you know, completely devastating for many of the bird species. So, and tortoises, of course, and iguanas.
Because they eat the eggs?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they'll just eat everything, eat the young and the eggs. And the kind of good example is on a small island called Pinzon, where when researchers went there in the 1960s and first started sort of taking stock of tortoises, like how many were still there, and they found tortoises, but they were all old, very old, you know, possibly more than 100 years old, most of them. And it wasn't because they weren't breeding, because they were breeding every year, but none of the offspring, they think, had survived for more than a century. So they're just getting eaten by rats. Usually the eggs before they hatch, but then if some of the hatchlings come out, they just get eaten. So there were no recruitment into that population, no juvenile tortoises at all, no young ones. And obviously the end point, if you carry on much longer, is extinction.
Mm-hmm.
They managed to kind of get round this rat problem by removing eggs and rearing hatchlings in captivity and reintroducing them when they're sort of rat-proof size. But the long-term solution for that is, of course, to remove rats from Pinzon. So I said it was a small island, but on a rat eradication scale, it's very big. It's sort of 18 kilometers squared. And so you've got to fly this helicopter fitted with a hopper and spray these pellets all over the island and not miss a bit, because if you miss a bit and you leave just a rat, then they bounce back. And I mean, that happened with goats on Pinta, which is another island. We're Lonesome George's Island in the 1970s, where they shot something like 40,000 goats in the space of the 1970s, but they left a few. And so there were another 10,000, you know, just a few. I mean, they would have only left two or three. If you leave one pregnant female, that's it.
Uh-huh.
That's all you need. And so that population of goats was not finally eradicated until around 2003 through some more sort of persistent methods.
Well, it's proof again that Galapagos Islands are very much still a laboratory for what we can and cannot do correctly in nature. Henry Nichols wrote the book, The Galapagos and Natural History. He's been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange today. Henry, a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange, it is Earth Day. We'll talk about Clean Energy Day coming and get a preview for that. We'll talk about getting college graduates into the forest products business. And then we'll talk about hunger in Oregon kids at 9 o'clock. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening and have a great day.